and shimmered like the area behind jet engines. Empty and dirty windowed rooms, doorknobs hot to touch, and hell stench inside the empty rooms. Steeply was continuing saying nothing while he tamped down another of his long Belgian cigarettes. Marat continued to hum the USA song, all over the map, in terms of key. The 3rd of November, YDAU. Because none of them really meant any of it, Hal tells Kent Blott. The end of the day hatred of all the work is just part of the work. You think Stitt and DeLint don't know we're going to sit in there together after showers and bitch? It's all planned out. The bitchers and moaners in there are just doing what's expected. But I look at these guys that have been here 6, 7 years, 8 years, still suffering, hurt, beat up, so tired, just like I feel tired and suffer. I feel this, what, dread, this dread. I see 7 or 8 years of unhappiness every day and day after day of tiredness and stress and suffering stretching ahead. And for what? For a chance at a pro career? That I'm starting to get this dready feeling a career in the show means even more suffering? If I'm skeletally stressed from all the grueling here by the time I get there? Blots on his back on the shag carpet. All 5 of them are. Stretched out, splay-limbed with their heads up, supported on double-width, velourish throw pillows on the floor of VR6. One of the 3 little viewing rooms on the 2nd floor of the ComEd building. 2 flights up from the locker rooms, and 3 from the main tunnel's mouth. The room's new cartridge viewer is huge and almost painfully high definition. It hangs flat on the north wall like a large painting. It runs off a refrigerated chip. The room's got no TP or phone console. It's very specialized. Just a player and viewer and tapes. The cartridge player sits on the 2nd shelf of a small bookcase beneath the viewer. The other shelves and several other cases are full of match cartridges, motivational and visualization cartridges. Interlace, Tatsuoka, Yoshityu, Cybervision. The 300-track wire from the cartridge player up to the lower right corner of the wall-hung viewer is so thin that it looks like a crack in the wall's white paint. Viewing rooms are windowless, and the air from the vent is stale. Though when the viewer's on, it looks like the room has a window. Hal's put on an undemanding visualization-type cartridge, as she usually does for a big buddy group interface when they're all tired. He's killed the volume so you can't hear the reinforcing mantra, but the picture is bright and bell clear. It's like the picture almost leaps out at you. A graying and somewhat ravaged-looking Stan Smith, in anachronistic white, is at a quartz baseline hitting textbook forehands over and over again. The same stroke, his back sort of osteoporotically hunched, but his form immaculate. His footwork textbook and effortless. The frictionless pivot and back set of weight. The anachronistic Wilson wood stick back and pointing straight to the fence behind him. The fluid transfer of weight to the front foot as the ball comes in. The contact at waist level and just out front, the front leg's muscles bunching up as the back legs settle, eyes glued to the yellow ball in the center of his string's stenciled W. ETA kids are conditioned to watch not just the ball, but the ball's rotating seams, to read the spin coming in. The front knee dipping slightly down under bulging quads as the weight flows more forward. The back foot up almost en pointe, on the gleaming sneaker's unscuffed toe. The no-nonsense, flourishless follow-through, so the stick ends up just in front of his gaunt face. Smith's cheeks have hollowed as he's aged. His face has collapsed at the sides. His eyes seem to bulge from the cheekbones that protrude as he inhales after impact. He looks desiccated, aged in hot light, performing the same motions over and over for decades. His other hand floating up gently to grasp the stick's throat out in front of the face, so he's flowed back into the ready stance all over again. No wasted motion, ego-less strokes, no flourishes or ticks or excesses of wrist. Over and over, each forehand melting into the next, a loop. It's hypnotizing. It's supposed to be. The soundtrack says, "Don't think, just see. Don't know, just flow." Over and over, if you turn it up. You're supposed to pretend it's you on the bell clear screen with the fluid and egoless strokes. You're supposed to disappear into the loop and then carry that disappearance out with you to play. The kids are lying there limp and splayed, supine, jaws slack, eyes wide and dim, a relaxed, exhausted warmth. The flooring beneath the shag is gently heated. Peter Beek is asleep with his eyes open, a queer talent ETA seems to instill in the younger ones. Oren had been able to sleep with his eyes open at the dinner table too at home. Hal's fingers, long and light brown and slightly sticky from tincture of benzoin, are laced behind his upraised head on the pillow, cupping his own skull, watching Stan Smith, eyes heavy too.
46.
You feel as though you'll be going through the exact same sort of suffering at 17 you suffer now here, Kent? Kent Blott has colored shoelaces on his sneakers with Mr. Bouncity Bounce program brand bow biters, which Hal finds extraordinarily artless and young. Peter Beek snores softly, a small spit bubble protruding and receding. But Blott, surely you've considered this. Why are they all still here then, if it's so awful every day? Not every day, Blott says, but pretty often it's awful. They're here because they want the show when they get out, Ingersoll sniffs and says. The show meaning the ATP tour. Travel and cash prizes and endorsements and appearance fees, match highlights and video mags, action photos and glossy print mags. But they know and we know one very top junior in 20 even gets all the way to the show, much less survives there long. The rest slog around on the satellite tours or regional tours or get soft as club pros or become lawyers or academics like everyone else, Hal says softly. And they stay and suffer to get a scholarship, a college ride, a white cardigan with a letter. Girl co-ed's keen on Letterman. Kent, except for Wayne and Pemulis, not one guy in there needs any kind of scholarship. Pemulis will get a full ride anywhere he wants, just on test scores. Stice says aunts will send him anywhere, even if he doesn't want to play. And Wayne's headed for the show. He'll never do more than a year on the ONANCAAs. Blott's father, a cutting-edge ENT oncologist, flew all over the world removing tumors from wealthy mucous membranes. Blott has a trust fund. None of that's the point, and you guys know it. They love the game, you're gonna say. Stan Smith has switched to backhands. They sure must love something, Ingersoll. But how about for a second I say that's not Kent's point either? Kent's point's the misery in that room just now. KB, I've taken part in essentially that same bitter, bitchy kind of session hundreds of times with those same guys after bad PMs, in the showers, in the sauna, at dinner. Very much bitching also in the lavatories, Arslanian says. Hal unsticks his hair from his fingers. Arslanian always has a queer, faint, hot dogish smell about him. The point is it's ritualistic, the bitching and moaning. Even assuming they feel the way they say when they get together, the point is, notice, we were all sitting there, all feeling the same way together. The point is togetherness? Shouldn't there be violas for this part, Hal, if this is the point? Ingersoll, Beek's cold weather adenoids wake him periodically, and he gurgles, and his eyes roll up briefly before they level out and he settles back, seeming to stare. Hal creatively visualizes that Smith's velvety backhand is him, slow-mo, slapping Evan Ingersoll into the opposite wall. Ingersoll's parents founded the Rhode Island version of the service where you order groceries by TP, and teenagers in fleets of station wagons bring them out to you instead of supermarkets. What the point is that we'd all just spent 3 hours playing challenges against each other in scrotum-tightening cold, assailing each other, trying to take away each other's spots on the squads, trying to defend them against each other's assaults, The system's got inequality as an axiom. We know where we stand entirely in relation to one another. John Wayne's over me, and I'm over Strzok and Shaw, who, 2 years back, were both over me but under Trolch and Schacht, and now are over Trolch, who, as of today, is over Freer, who substantially over Schacht, who can't beat anyone in the room except Pemula since his knee and Crohn's disease got so much worse and is barely hanging on in terms of ranking and is showing incredible balls just hanging on. Freer beat me 4-2 in the quarters of the U.S. Clays 2 summers ago, and now he's on the B squad and 5 slots below me. 6 slots if Trolch can still beat him when they play again after that illness default.
I am over Blatt. I am over Ingersoll.
Idris Arslanian nods. Well, Blatt's just 10, Idris. And you're under Chu, who's on an odd year and is under Postlethwaite. And Blatt's under Beek and Ingersoll simply by virtue of age division.
I know just where I stand at all times, muses Ingersoll.
Cybervision edits its visualization sequences with a melt filter, so Stan Smith's follow-through loops seamlessly into his backswing for the exact same next stroke. The transitions are gauzy and dreamlike. Hal struggles to hike himself up onto his elbows. We're all on each other's food chain, all of us. It's an individual sport. Welcome to the meaning of individual. We're each deeply alone here. It's what we all have in common, this aloneness.
E unibus plurum, Ingersoll muses.
Hal looks from face to face. Ingersoll's face is completely devoid of eyebrows and is round and dustily freckled, not unlike a Mrs. Clark pancake. So how can we also be together? How can we be friends? How can Ingersoll root for Arslanian in Idris's singles at the Port Washington thing when if Idris loses, Ingersoll gets to challenge for his spot again?
I do not require his root, for I am ready,
Arslanian bears canines. Well, that's the whole point. How can we be friends? Even if we all live and eat and shower and play together, how can we keep from being 136 deeply alone people all jammed together?
You're talking about community. This is a community spiel.
I think alienation,
Arslanian says, rolling the profile over to signify he's talking to Ingersoll.
Existential individuality, frequently referred to in the West. Solipsism.
His upper lip goes up and down over his teeth. Hal says, in a nutshell, what we're talking about here is loneliness. Blatt looks about ready to cry. Beek's palsied eyes and little limb spasms signify a troubling dream. Blatt rubs his nose furiously with the heel of his hand.
I miss my dog, Ingersoll concedes.
Ah. Hal rolls onto one elbow to hike a finger into the air.
Ah.
But then, so, notice the instant group cohesion that formed itself around all the pissing and moaning down there, why don't you? Blatt, you, Kent, this is your question. The what looks like sadism, the skeletal stress, the fatigue. The suffering unites us. They want to let us sit around and bitch together. After a bad PM set, we all, however briefly, get to feel we have a common enemy. This is their gift to us, their medicine. Nothing brings you together like a common enemy.
Mr. DeLint.
Dr. Tavis. Shtit.
DeLint, Watson, Nwagi, Thode. All Shtit's henchmen and henchwomen. I hate them,
Blatt cries out. And you've been here this long and you still think this hatred's an accident?
Purchase a clue, Kent Blatt,
Arslanian says.
The large and economy-sized clue, Blatt, Ingersoll chimes.
Beek sits up and says,
God, no, not with pliers,
and collapses back again with a spit bubble. Hal is pretending incredulity.
You guys haven't noticed yet the way Shtit's whole staff gets progressively more foul-tempered and sadistic as an important competitive week comes up?
Ingersoll up on one elbow to Blatt.
The Port Washington meet, ID Day, the Tucson Whataburger the week after? They want us in absolute top shape, Blatt.
Hal lies back and lets Smith Spelladese loosen his facial muscles again, staring.
Shit, Ingersoll, we're all in top shape already. That's not it. That's the least of it. We're off the charts, shape-wise.
Ingersoll.
The average North American kid can't even do one pull-up, according to Nwangi.
Arslanian points down to his own chest.
28 pull-ups.
The point, Hal says softly, is that it's not about the physical anymore, men. The physical stuff's just pro forma. It's the heads they're working on here, boys. Day and year, in and out, a whole program. It'll help your attitude to look for evidence of design. They always give us something to hate, really hate together, as big stuff looms. The dreaded May drills during finals before the summer tour, the post-Christmas crackdown before Australia, the November freeze-a-thon, the snot fest, the delay in upping the lung and getting us undercover, a common enemy. I may despise K.B. Freer, or, can't quite resist, Evan Ingersoll, or Jenny Bash, but we despise Stitzmen, the double matches on top of runs, the insensitivity to exams, the repetition, the stress, the loneliness. But we get together and bitch. All of a sudden, we're giving something. Group expression. A community voice. Community, Evan. Oh, they're cunning. They give themselves up to our dislike, calculate our breaking points, and aim for just over them. They send us into the locker room with an unstructured 45 before big buddy sessions. Accident? Random happenstance? You guys ever see evidence of the tiniest lack of coolly calculated structure around here?
The structure is what I hate the most of all, Ingersoll says.
They know what's going on, Blott says, bouncing a little on his tailbone. They want us to get together and complain.
Oh, they're cunning,
Ingersoll says. Hal curls himself a bit on one elbow to put in a small plug of Kodiak. He can't tell whether Ingersoll's being insolent. He lies there, very slack, visualizing Smith pounding overheads down onto Ingersoll's skull. Hal, some weeks back, had acquiesced to Lyle's diagnosis that Hal finds Ingersoll, this smart, soft, caustic kid with a big, soft, eyebrowless face and unwrinkled thumb joints, with the runty, cuddled look of a mama's boy from way back, a quick intelligence he squanders on an insatiable need to advance some impression of himself, that the kid so repels Hal because Hal sees in the kid certain parts of himself he can't or won't accept. None of this ever occurs to Hal when Ingersoll's in the room. He wishes him ill. Blott and Arslanian are looking at him.
Are you okay?
He is tired, Arslanian says.
Ingersoll drums idly on his own ribcage. Hal usually gets secretly high so regularly these days this year that if by dinner time he hasn't gotten high yet, that day, his mouth begins to fill with spit, some rebound effect from B. Hope's desiccating action, and his eyes start to water, as if he's just yawned. The smokeless tobacco started almost as an excuse to spit, sometimes. Hal, struck by the fact that he really, for the most part, believes what he said about loneliness and the structured need for a we here, and this, together with the Ingersoll repulsion and spit flood, makes him uncomfortable again, brooding uncomfortably for a moment on why he gets off on the secrecy of getting high in secret, more than on the getting high itself, possibly. He always gets the feeling there's some clue to it on the tip of his tongue, some mute and inaccessible part of the cortex, and then he always feels vaguely sick scanning for it. The other thing that happens if he doesn't do one-hitters sometime before dinner is he feels slightly sick to his stomach, and it's hard to eat enough at dinner, and then later when he does go off and get off, he gets ravenous and goes out to Father and Son Market for candy, or else floods his eyes with murine and heads down to the headmaster's house for another late dinner with CT and the moms, and eats like such a feral animal that the moms says it does something instinctively maternal in her heart good to see him pack it away. But then he wakes before dawn with awful indigestion.
So the suffering gets less lonely,
Blott prompts him. Two curves down the hall in VR5, where the viewer's on the south wall and doesn't get turned on,
The Canadian John Waynes got Lamont Chu and Sleepy T.P. Peterson and Kieran McKenna and Brian Van Vleck.
He's talking about developing the concept of tennis mastery,
Chu tells the other three. They're on the floor, Indian style. Wayne standing with his back against the door, rotating his head to stretch the neck.
His point is that progress towards genuine show-caliber mastery is slow, frustrating, humbling, a question of less talent than temperament. Is that right, Mr. Wayne?
Chu says that because you proceed toward mastery through a series of plateaus, so there's like radical improvement up to a certain plateau, and then what looks like a stall on the plateau, with the only way to get off one of the plateaus and climb up to the next one up ahead is with a whole lot of frustrating, mindless, repetitive practice and patience and hanging in there.
Plateaus, Wayne says, looking at the ceiling and pushing the back of his head isometrically against the door. With an X, plateaus.
The inactive viewer screen is the color of way out over the Atlantic looking straight down on a cold day. Chu's cross-legged posture is textbook.
What John's saying is the types who don't hang in there and slog on the patient road toward mastery are basically three types. You've got what he calls your despairing type, who's fine as long as he's in the quick improvement stage before a plateau. But then he hits a plateau and sees himself seem to stall, not getting better as fast, or even seeming to get a little worse. And this type gives into frustration and despair, because he hasn't got the humbleness and patience to hang in there and slog. And he can't stand the time he has to put in on plateaus. And what happens?
Geronimo! The other kids yell, not quite in sync.
He bails, right, Chu says.
He refers to index cards. Wayne's head makes the door rattle slightly. Chu says,
then you've got your obsessive type, JW says. So eager to plateau hop, he doesn't even know the word patient, much less humble or slog. When he gets stalled at a plateau, he tries to, like, will and force himself off it by sheer force of work and drill and will and practice, drilling and obsessively honing and working more and more, as in frantically, and he overdoes it and gets hurt, and pretty soon he's all chronically messed up with injuries, and he hobbles around on the court still obsessively overworking until finally he's hardly even able to walk or swing, and his ranking plummets until finally 1 p.m. there's a little knock on his door, and it's DeLint. Here for a little chat about your progress here at ETA.
Bonsai! El Balo, see ya!
Then what John considers maybe the worst type, because it can cunningly masquerade as patience and humble frustration. You've got the complacent type, who improves radically until he hits a plateau, and is content with the radical improvement he's made to get to the plateau, and doesn't mind staying at the plateau because it's comfortable and familiar, and he doesn't worry about getting off it. And pretty soon you find he's designed a whole game around compensating for the weaknesses and chinks in the armor the given plateau represents in his game. Still, his whole game is based on this plateau now. And little by little, guys he used to beat start beating him, locating the chinks of the plateau, and his rank starts to slide. But he'll say he doesn't care. He says he's in it for the love of the game, and he always smiles, but there gets to be something sort of tight and hangdog about his smile. And he always smiles and is real nice to everybody and real good to have around, but he keeps staying where he is while other guys hop plateaus. And he gets beat more and more, but he's content. Until one day there's a quiet knock at the door.
It's DeLint! A quiet chat.
Geronzai!
Van Vleck looks up at Wayne, who's now turned away with his hands against the doorframe, shoving, one leg back, stretching the right calf.
This is your advice, Mr. Wayne, sir? This isn't Chu palming himself off as you again.
They all want to know how Wayne does it. Number two continentally in 18s at just 17, and very likely number one after the Whataburger, and already getting calls from ProServe agents, Tavis as lateral Alice Moore screen. Wayne's the most sought-after big buddy at ETA. You have to apply for Wayne as big buddy by random drawing. Lamont Chu and T.P. Peterson are sending Van Vleck optical daggers as Wayne turns around to stretch a hip flexor and says he's said pretty much all he has to say.
Todder, I admire your savvy. I admire a kid's certain worldly skepticism, no matter how misplaced it is here. So even though it fucks me on the odds, so there's now, like, practically no way I can come out square.
M. Pemulis says, in VR2, subdorm C, sitting on the very edge of the divan with a few feet of beige shag between him and his four kids, all cross-legged on cushions. He says, I'll reward your worldly skepticism this once by letting you try it with only two. So, like, I've got just two cards here, and I hold them up, one in each hand. He stops abruptly, knocks his temple with the heel of a hand that holds a jack.
Whoa, what am I thinking? We all gotta put in our fiveski here first.
Otis P. Lord clears his throat.
The ante.
Or it's called the pot,
says Todd Postlethwaite, laying a five on the little pile.
Jesus, I'm thinking, sweet Jesus, what am I getting into with these kids that speak the lingo like veteran Jersey Shore croupiers? I gotta be missing a widget or something. To the fuck, though, you know what I'm saying? So, Todd, man, you choose just one of the cards. We got the clubby jack and the spade queen here, and you choose. And so down they go, both of them face down. And I, like, swirl them around on the floor a little. Not shuffle, but swirl, so they're in plain view the whole time. And you follow the card you chose around and around, which, like, with three cards, maybe I've got some chance you lose track, but with two, with just two.
Ted shocked in VR3 at his giant plasticine oral demonstrator. The huge dental mock-up, white planks of teeth, and obscene pink gums, twine-sized floss anchored around both wrists.
The vital thing here, gentlemen, being not the force or how often you rotate to particulate-free floss, but the motion, see? A soft sawing motion, gently up and down both ancipitals of the enamel,
demonstrating down the side of a bicuspid, big as the kids' heads, the plasticine gum stuff yielding with sick sucking sounds. Shocked's five kids all either glazed-looking or glued to their watches secondhand.
And then here's the key. Here's the thing so few people understand. Down below the ostensible gum line into the basal recessions at either side of the gingival mound that obtrudes between the teeth down below where your most pernicious particulates hide and breed.
Trulch holds court in his Pemulis and Shocked's room in subdorm C, supinely upright against both of his and one of Shocked's pillows, the vaporizer chugging, one of his kids holding Kleenex at the ready.
Boys, what it is, I'll tell you, it's repetition. First, last, always. It's hearing the same motivational stuff over and over till sheer repetitive weight makes it sink down into the gut. It's making the same pivots and lunges and strokes over and over and over again. At you boys' age, it's reps for their own sake. Putting results on the back burner. Why, they never give anybody the boot for insufficient progress under 14. It's repetitive movements and motions for their own sake over and over until the accretive weight of reps sinks the movements themselves down under your, like, consciousness into the more nether regions. Through repetition, they sink and soak into the hardware, the CPS, the machine language, the autonomical part that makes you breathe and sweat. It's no accident they say you eat, sleep, breathe tennis here. These are autonomical. Accretive means accumulating through sheer, mindless, repeated motions. The machine language of the muscles, until you can do it without thinking about it. Play. At like 14, give and take, they figure here. Just do it. Forget about is there a point. Of course there's no point. The point of repetition is there is no point.
Wait until it soaks into the hardware, then see the way this frees up your head. A whole shitload of headspace you don't need for the mechanics anymore after they've sunk in. Now the mechanics are wired in, hardwired in. This frees the head in the remarkablest ways. Just wait. You start thinking a whole different way now playing. The court might as well be inside you. The ball stops being a ball. The ball starts being something that you just know ought to be in the air, spinning. This is when they start getting on you about concentration. Right now, of course, you have to concentrate. There's no choice. It's not wired down into the language yet. You have to think about it every time you do it. But wait till 14 or 15. Then they see you as being at one of the, like, crucial plateaus. 15 tops. Then the concentration and character shit starts. Then they really come after you. This is the crucial plateau where character starts to matter. Focus, self-consciousness, the chattering head, the cackling voices, the choking issue, fear versus whatever isn't fear, self-image, doubts, reluctances, little tight-lipped, cold-footed men inside your mind, cackling about fear and doubt, chinks in the mental armor. Now these start to matter. 13 at the earliest. Staff looks at a range of 13 to 15. Also, the age of manhood rituals in various cultures. Think about it. Until then, repetition. Until then, you might as well be machines here, is their view. You're just going through the motions. Think about the phrase, going through the motions. Wiring them into the motherboard. You guys don't know how good you've got it right now.
James Albrecht Lockley Struck Jr. of Orinda, California, prefers one long Q&A type interface, with VR8's viewer playing ambient stuff against relaxation vistas of surf, shimmering ponds, fields of nodding wheat. Time for about maybe two more, Midroogies. Say it's close and the guy starts kertwanging you. Balls are way in and he's calling them out. You can't believe the flagrancy of it. Implicit, this is a no-linesman situation, Traub, you're saying? Creepily blue-eyed, Audern Talat Kelpsa chimes in. This is early rounds, the kind they give you only two balls, honor systems. All of a sudden, there he is, kertwanging on you. It happens.
I know it happens,
Traub says. Whether he's outright kertwanging or just head-fucking you, do you start kertwanging back, tit for tat? What do you do?
Do we assume there's a crowd?
Early round, remote court, no witnesses. You're on your own out there. Do you kertwang back?
You do not kertwang back. You play the calls, not a word. Keep smiling. If you still win, you'll have grown inside as a person.
If you lose?
If you lose, you do something private and unpleasant to his water jug right before his next round.
A couple of kids have notebooks and studious nods. Struck is a prized tactician, very formal in BB group sessions, something scholarly and detached about him, his charges often revere.
We can discuss private water jug unpleasantness on Friday, Struck says, looking at his watch.
A hand raised by the violently cross-eyed Carl Whale, age 13. Acknowledgement from Struck.
Say you have to fart.
You're serious, Mobes, aren't you?
Jim, sir, say you're playing out there, and suddenly you have to fart. It feels like one of those real hot, nasty, pressurized ones.
I get the picture.
Now, some empathic murmurs, exchanged looks. Josh Gopnik is nodding very intensely. Struck stands very straight to the right of the viewer, hands behind his back like an Oxford Don.
I mean, the kind that's real urgent.
Whale looks briefly around him.
But that it's not impossible, it's actually a need to go to the bathroom instead, masquerading as a fart.
Now five heads are nodding, pained, urgent, clearly a vexing sub-14 issue.
Struck examines a cuticle. Meaning defecate is what you mean then, Bobes. Go to the bathroom.
Gopnik looks up.
Carl's saying the kind where you don't know what to do.
What if you think you have to fart, but it's really that you have to shit? As in, it's a competitive situation. It's not a situation where you can go bearing down and forcing and see what happens.
So out of caution, you don't, Gopnik says.
Fart,
Philip Traub says.
But then you've denied yourself an urgent fart, and you're running around trying to compete with a terrible, hot, nasty, uncomfortable fart riding around the court inside you.
Two levels down, Orthostice and his brood, the little library-ish circle of soft chairs and lamps in the warm foyer off the front door to sub-dorm C.
And what he says it's about more than tennis, mein Kinder. Mein Kinder? Well, it sort of means my family. He eyeballs me right square in the eye and says it's about how to reach down into parts of yourself you didn't know were there and get down in there and live inside these parts. And the only way to get to them, sacrifice, suffer, deny. What are you willing to give?
You'll hear him ask it if you're privileged to ever get an interface.
The call could come at any time. The man wants a mono-to-mono interface.
You'll hear him say it over and over. What have you got to give? What are you willing to part with?
I see you're looking a little pale there, Wagen-necked. Is this scary? You bet your little pink personal asses it's scary. It's a big time. He'll tell you straight the fuck out. It's about discipline and sacrifice and honor to something way bigger than your personal ass. He'll mention America. He'll talk patriotism, and don't think he won't. He'll talk about its patriotic play that's the high road to the thing. He's not American, but I tell you straight out right here, he makes me proud to be American, mein Kinder.
He'll say it's how to learn to be a good American during a time, boys, when America isn't good to its own self.
There's a long pause. The front door is newer than the wood around it.
I chew fiberglass for that old man.
The only reason the buddies in VR-8 can hear the little burst of applause from the foyer is because Strzok won't hesitate to pause and consider silently as long as he has to. To the kids, the pauses spell dignity and integrity and the still water depth of a guy with 9 years in at 3 different academies and who has to shave daily. He exhales a slow breath through rounded lips, looking off up at the ceiling's galoche border.
Mobes, if it's me,
I let it ride.
You let it out come what may?
A la contraire. I let it ride around inside all day if I have to. I make an iron rule. Nothing escapes my bottom during play. Not a toot or a whistle. If I play hunched over, I play hunched over. I take the discomfort in the name of dignified caution. And when it's especially bad, I look up at the sky between points and I say to the sky, thank you, sir, may I have another? Thank you, sir, may I have another?
Gopnik and Talek Kelpsa are writing this down. Strzok says,
that's if I want to hang for the long haul.
One side of the gingival mound, then up over the apex and down over the other side of the gingival mound, using you should cultivate a certain amount of touch with the string.
Now, the big question of character is, do we let a fluke of a probably 1 in 100 lapse in concentration make us throw up our faggy hands and go dragging characterlessly back to our dens to lick the whimpering wounds? Or do we narrow our eyes and put out the chin and say, Pemulus? We say, Pemulus, double or nothing, when the odds remain so almost crazily stacked in our favor today.
So they do it on purpose? Beak is asking. Try to make us hate them? Limits and rituals. It's almost time for communal dinner. Sometimes Mrs. Clark in the kitchen lets Mario ring a triangle with a steel ladle while she rolls back the dining room doors. They make the servers wear hairnets and little OBGYN-ish gloves. Hal could take out the plug and nip down into the tunnels,
maybe not even all the way down into the pump room.
Be only 20 minutes late.
He's thinking in an abstract, absent way about limits and rituals, listening to Blot give Beak his apersu. Like as in, is there a clear line, a quantifiable difference between need and just strong desire? He has to sit up to spit in the wastebasket. There is a twinge and a tooth on his mouth's left side. Mario Incandenza's first and only, even remotely romantic experience thus far. In mid-October, YDAU, Hal had invited Mario for a post-prandial stroll, and they were strolling the ETA grounds between the West Courts and the hillside's tree line, Hal with his gear bag. Mario could sense that Hal wanted to be able to go off by himself briefly, so he contrived, Mario did, to be very interested in some sort of leaf and twig ensemble off the path, and let Hal sort of melt away down the path. The whole area running along the tree line, and the thickets of light shrubbery and stickery bushes, and heaven knew what all was covered with fallen leaves that were dry but had not yet quite all the way lost their color. The leaves were underfoot. Mario kind of tottered from tree to tree, pausing at each tree to rest. It was at 1900 hours, not yet true twilight, but the only thing left of the sunset was a snout just over Newton, and the places under long shadows were cold, and a certain kind of melancholy sadness was insinuating itself into the ground's light. The staggered lamps by the paths hadn't come on yet, however. A lovely scent of illegally burned leaves wafting up from East Newton, mixed with the foodie smells from the ventilator turbines out of the back of the dining hall. Two gulls were in one place in the air over the dumpsters over by the rear parking lot. Leaves crackled underfoot. The sound of Mario walking in dry leaves was like crackle, 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 stop. Crackle, 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 stop. An Empire Waste displacement vehicle whistled past overhead, rising in the start of its arc, its one blue alert light a twinkle. He was around where the tree line bulged herniatically out toward the end of the West Court's fencing. From deeper inside the thickets on the lip of the hillside came a tremendous crackling and thrashing of underbrush and trailing willow branches, and who should heave into unexpected view but the USS Millicent Kent, a 16-year-old out of Montclair, New Jersey, number one singles on the girls' 16s A squad, and 200 kilos if she was a kilo. Southpaw, one-hander off the backhand side, a serve Donnie Stott likes to clock with radar and chart. Mario's filmed the USS Millicent Kent for staff analysis on several occasions. They exchange hearty highs. One of only a couple female ETAs with visible veins in her forearms, object of a fiercely wagered-on bench press challenge against Schacht, Freer, and Petropolis Khan that M. Pemulis had organized last spring, in which she'd topped Khan, and Freer refused to show, and Schacht finally beat her but doffed his cap. Out for a staff-ordered weight management post-dinner stroll, squeezing pen fives in both hands, in ETA sweatpants, and with an enormous violet bow either scotch-taped or glued to the blunt, rounded top of her hair. She told Mario she'd just seen the strangest thing farther back, deeper in the thickets off the lip. Her hair was tall and rounded off in the shape of a kind of pill, not unlike a papal hat or a British constable's tall hat. Mario said the bow looked terrific, and what a surprise to come face-to-face like this out here in the chill dusk. Bridget Boone had said the USS Millicent Kent's coiffure looked like a missile protruding from its silo in preparation for launch. The last of the sun's snout was setting just over the tip of the USS Millicent's hair, which was almost osseously hard-looking, composed of dense woven nests of reticulate fibers like a dry loofah sponge, which she said over the summer a home perm had misfired and left her hair a system of reticulate nests, and was only now loosening up enough even to attach a bow to. Mario said that, well, the bow set her off to a T, was all he had to say on the matter.
He hadn't literally said chill dusk. The USS MK said she'd been amusing herself beating her way through one of the brambly thickets Mrs. Incandenza had, when she'd still spent time outdoors at all, planted to discourage part-time employees from shortcutting up the hillside to ETA, and had come upon a Husky 6 brand telescoping tripod, new and dully silvery-looking, and set up on its three legs, right in the middle of the thicket. For no visible reason, and with no footprints or visible evidence of path beating anywhere around except the USS Millicent's own. The USS Millicent Kent stowed a tennis ball in each hip pocket and took Mario's claw and said, here, to walk this way, and she'd show him real quick, and get his, like, feedback on the issue, and, plus, have a witness when they got back, and she told people about it. Mario said the Husky 6 came with its own panhead and cable release. With the girl supporting him with one hand and beating an easement through the brush with the other, they proceeded deeper into the thicket on the lip. The outdoor light was now the same hue as USS MK's hair bow. She said she swore to God it was around here someplace. Mario said his late dad had used a somewhat less snazzy 6 model Husky back in his early days of making art films, when he also made a homemade dolly and sandbags and halogen spots instead of Kleegs. Several different species and types of birds were twittering. The USS Millicent Kent told Mario that, off the record, she'd always felt he had the longest, luscious, prettiest lashes of any boy on 2 continents. 3, if you counted Australia. Mario thanked her kindly, calling her ma'am and trying to fake a southern accent. The USS Millicent Kent said she wasn't sure what were her old footprints from finding the thicket with the tripod and what were their more recent footprints from trying to find the old footprints, and that she was worried because it was starting to get dark and they might not be able to find it, and then Mario wouldn't believe she'd seen something as batshit sounding as a gleaming, silvery tripod all set up for no reason in the middle of Nowheresville. Mario said he was pretty sure that Australia was a continent. Walking, he came up to around the bottom of USS Millicent's ribcage. Mario heard crackling and thrashing from some other thicket nearby, but was certain it wasn't Hal, since Hal very rarely made a lot of motion noise, either outside or in. The USS Millicent Kent told Mario that though she was an admittedly great player, with an overwhelming haul ass up to the net and loom over it like a Titan game in the Betty Stove / Venus Williams power game tradition, and headed for an almost limitless future in the show, she'd confide in him in private out here that she'd never really loved competitive tennis, that her real love and passion was modern interpretive dance, at which she admittedly had less unconsciously native gifts and talents to bring to bear, but which she loved and had spent just about all her off-court time as a little girl practicing in a leotard in front of a double-width mirror in her room at home in suburban Montclair, New Jersey. But that tennis was what she had limitless talent at and got emotional strokes and tuition waiver boarding school offers in, and that she'd been desperate to get into a boarding school. Mario asked if she could recall if the Husky 6 tripod had been the TL one with waffle-gridded rubber tips on the legs and a 360-degree panhead, or the SL one with unwaffled tips and only a 180-degree panhead, that swiveled in an arc instead of a full circle. The USS Millicent revealed that she'd accepted a scholarship to ETA at age 9 for the sole reason of getting away from her father. She referred to her father as her old man, which you can just tell she capitalizes. Her mother had left home when the USS Millicent was only 5, running off very abruptly with a man sent by what had then been called Con Edison to do a free home energy efficiency assessment. It had been 6 years since she'd laid an eyeball on her old man, but to the best of her recall, he was almost 3 meters tall and morbidly obese, which had been why every mirror and bathtub in the house had been double width. One older sister, who'd been deeply involved in synchronized swimming, had got pregnant and married in high school soon after her mother's departure. All this time, there's been more crackling and crashing off up the hillside.
Mario has trouble on any kind of declined grade. Some sort of birds sitting in the top branch of a little tree and looking at them without saying anything. Mario thinks suddenly of a joke he remembers hearing Michael Pemulis tell.
If two people get married in West Virginia and then pull up stakes and move to Massachusetts, and then if they decide they want to get a divorce, what's the biggest problem getting a divorce?
The USSMK says her other older sister had at just 15 joined the Icecapades of all things and was in the backup-like chorus where the biggest artistic challenge was not bumping into people and either falling or making them fall.
Getting a divorce from your sister. Because in West Virginia, Pemulis said, a lot of people who get married are brother and sister.
Hold my hand.
He was only joking, though.
By now the light was about the same color as the ash and clinkers in the bottom of a Weber grill. The USS Millicent Kent was leading them in a set of slightly diminishing circles. Then, she said, at age 8, she came home early from after-school drills at the USTA Junior Facility in Passaic, New Jersey, looking forward to slipping into the old leotard and getting in some modern interpretive dancing up in her room, only to come home suddenly and find her father wearing her leotard, which, needless to say, didn't fit very well. And with a small front portion of his huge bare feet squeezed into a pair of strapless pumps Mrs. Kent had left behind in her haste. In the dining room, he'd moved all the furniture over to the side of, in front of, the really wide mirror, and a grotesquely tiny and bulging violet leotard, capering. Mario says violet's really the USS Millicent's color. She says that was the exact creepy word for it, capering. Pirouetting and rondling. Simpering as well. The crotch of her leotard looked like a slingshot. It was so deformed. He hadn't heard her come in. USS Millicent asked Mario if he'd ever seen a girl's yin-yang before. Obscene mottled hirsute flesh had pooched and spilled out over every centimeter of the leotard's perimeter, she recalled. She'd had a voluptuous figure even at 8, she told Mario, but the old man was in a whole different-sized ballpark altogether. Mario kept saying, "Golly, Ned," all he could think of to say. His flesh jiggled and bounced as he capered. It was repellent, she said. There was no sign of a Husky 6 or any other model of tripod in any of the thickets and boscages. Her literal term for it was yin-yang. But her old man wasn't just a cross-dressing transvestite, she said. It turned out they always had to be a relative's female clothes. She said she always used to wonder why her sister's one-pieces and figure-skating skirts always looked so askewly baggy and elastic shot, since the sisters didn't exactly wear tiny little malnourished sizes themselves. The old man didn't hear her come in, and he capered and jeted for several more minutes until she happened to catch his simpering eye in the mirror, she said. That's when she knew she had to get away, she said. And Mario's own old man's admissions lady had called out of the blue that very evening, she said, like it had been fate. Serendipity. Kismet.
Yin-yang, Mario offered, nodding.
The U.S. Millicent's hand was large and hot and at the level of sogginess of a bath mat that's been used several times in a row in quick succession. Her second oldest sister, many years later, had informed the USSMK that the first time anybody'd had any inklings about the old man was an episode when the older sister was very small and Mrs. K had sewed her a special costume, complete with gold lame bow and arrow for playing Cupid in the school Valentine's Day pageant. And the sister school had got out early one day after an asbestos scare, and she'd come unexpectedly home and found the old man in the basement, rumpus room, in tiny wings and hideously distended diaper, striking a pose from a rather well-known Titian oil in the Met's high Renaissance wing. And had struggled with denial and own perceptions doubting for quite some time thereafter, until an hysterical episode during rehearsals for an Icecapades Valentine's Day number brought all the feelings surging up and broke the denial, and the Icecapades Employee Assistance Office counseling staff helped her start to work it all through.
At which point USS Millicent stopped them in an unprickly thicket of what later turned out to be poison sumac, and turned with a strange glint in the one eye that wasn't in pine shadow, and crushed Mario's large head to the area just below her breasts, and said she needed to confess that Mario's eyelashes and vest with extendable police lock he used for staying upright in one place had for quite some time now driven her right around the bend with sensual feeling. What Mario perceived as a sudden, radical drop in the prevailing temperature was, in fact, the USS Millicent Kent's sexual stimulation, sucking tremendous quantities of ambient energy out of the air surrounding them. Mario's face was so squashed against the USS Millicent's thorax that he had to contort his mouth way out to the left to breathe. USS MK's hair bow became detached and fluttered down through Mario's sightline like a giant crazed violet moth. USS MK was trying to undo Mario's corduroys, but was frustrated by the complex system of snaps and fasteners at the bottom of his police lock's Velcro vest, which overlapped his trousers' own fasteners, and Mario tried to reconfigure his mouth somehow to both breathe and warn the USS MK that he was incredibly ticklish in that area of the belly button and directly below. He could now start to hear his brother howl somewhere to the above and east, calling Mario's name at a moderate volume. The USS Millicent Kent was saying there was no way Mario could be any more nervous than she was about what was happening between them. It's true that the sounds of Mario sucking air out of a severely leftward contorted mouth could have been interpretable as the heavy breathing of sexual stimulation. It was when the USS Millicent wrapped one arm around his shoulder for leverage and forced her other hand up under the hem of the tight vest, and then down inside the trousers and briefs, rooting for a penis, that Mario became so ticklish that he began to double up, clearing his face of USS Millicent's front and laughing out loud in such a distinctive, high-pitched way that Hal had no trouble beelining right upon them, compromised though his navigational systems were after 15 or so secret minutes alone in the fragrant pines. Mario later said it was just like when there was a word on the tip of your tongue that, try as you might, you can't remember until the exact second you stop trying, and in it pops, right into your head. It was when the three of them were walking together, back up the hillside toward the tree line's lip, not trying to do anything but get back to ComEd, by the most direct route in the dark, that they stumbled upon the cinematic tripod, a dully glinting TL waffle-tipped husky, in the middle of what wasn't such a very tall or thick thicket at all. 30th of April, year of the Depend Adult Undergarment. Steeply said, choosing Boston as your op center, after all, which to us signifies the place of the supposed entertainment's origin. Marat made a gesture of being willing to take time and play along, if Steeply wished it.
But also the city Boston, USA, has logic. Your closest city to the convexity, closest therefore to Quebec, within, as you say, the distance of speed.
His wheelchair squeaked very slightly whenever he moved.
An automobile horn somewhere between the city and themselves blew a sustained blast. It grew always colder down on the desert floor. They could feel this. He felt gratitude for his windbreaker.
Steeply flicked some ashes from his cigarette with a coarse thumb gesture that was not yet feminine.
But we're not any more sure that they actually do have copies. Also, does this, quote, anti-entertainment the film's director supposedly made to counter the lethality, does it really also exist? This really could be some sort of game for you and the FLQ to hold out the promise of the anti-entertainment as a chip for concessions, as some kind of remedy or antidote.
47.
Of this anti-film that antidotes the seduction of the entertainment, we have no evidence except craziness of rumors.
Steeply used a technical interviewer's device of pretending to occupy himself with small physical chores of preening and hygiene, delaying to have Marat elaborate himself more fully. The lights of the city Tucson, with their movements and twinkling,
made a globe of light, such as on ceilings,
at La Salle de Danse in Val-d'Or, Quebec.
Marat's wife was dying slowly of ventricular restenosis.